What do you get?
Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. Well, we've reached the end of our season on Company, and it's been a good journey, I think, at least. So right here at the top, I just wanted to tell you that I've included a link to a Google survey down in the show notes that I'd really appreciate you filling out, as it'll make sure that this show continually improves. I think that audience suggestions have only made this podcast better, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. One of the things that I know I want to get better at is giving myself more time for research and adding that into the beginnings here and throughout the interviews I have with my guests. To that point, I'm going to be taking a longer break than usual. Our next season will be Follies, which I'm super excited about, but in order to record the majority of the episodes and do some reading, I'm taking 6 weeks off. Which means, unless there is a great opportunity that pops up between now and then, the next episode in your feeds will be on May 20th. So don't think I've gone away. There'll be a bunch more to talk about when I get back. Although I did want to include, before we start our episode today, an email that I want to read a portion of that was sent in by Stephen Miller. Remember, not the Stephen Miller of such roles as Guy on News and Person I See Tweeted About. He's also a great Patreon supporter, but he sent this in about Barcelona. I'm jumping kind of into the middle of his email where he was discussing what he thinks is the disconnect between him and April and kind of the cynicism of Bobby himself. But I think this disconnect is why we have April's cynicism throughout most of the song, which is eventually worn down by Bobby protesting a bit too much. I also think he feels pretty safe insisting she stay since he thinks there's no way she'll blow off her flight and her job. And then, of course, this plan backfires as she eventually does believe he wants more than a one-night stand. Oh God, indeed. Since Company is such a show of ideas, I've always thought of this scene as representing a larger womanizing pattern for Bobby, and his comical despair at the end of the scene so beautifully sets up the callous emptiness he feels going into the following scene with Joanne, and then, of course, into his eventual catharsis with being alive. God, I love this show. I love this show, too. And because me and Eric talked quite a bit about being alive, let's get to Plodding Along. Plodding Along is a part of the show where I describe to you what's happening in the plot. So after Ladies Who Lunch, Joanne and Larry go home, leaving Robert/Bobby alone on stage. The familiar Bobby, Bobby baby, Bobby booby starts up, and Bobby angrily shouts, "Stop!" and launches into being alive. After this song, the opening birthday party starts again, but this time, Bobby never showed up. His friends leave, and then Bobby appears, alone, to blow out his candles. Eric Matthew Richardson returns to the show, and we get into it. So let's thank some sponsors, and then when we return, we'll be talking about the song Being Alive with guest Eric Matthew Richardson. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Pod Power. With Pod Power, ATB is making it possible for us to amplify the voices of Albertans and Alberta podcasters. This episode, we're giving a Pod Power shout-out to Let's Get Lit. Let's Get Lit is a poetry podcast presented by the Writers Guild of Alberta. In each episode, hosts Rayanne Haynes and Matthew Stepanek interview poets based in Alberta and Western Canada about the power of poetry to support and promote arts and literacy. They also enjoy a glass of wine, chosen to match the poet's personality and style, while learning more about each poet and asking why poetry matters. You can listen to Let's Get Lit on Audio Boom or wherever you get your podcasts. Find out more at writersguild.ca. That's writersguild.ca. This week, Putting It Together is also brought to you by the Alberta Podcast Network. So let's go and take a listen to one of the great shows. Hello. The podcast you're listening to is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. I'm Kyle, and I'm the host of Creative Block. It's a podcast where I talk with artists and creative entrepreneurs. So if you're curious to understand the minds of theater producers, local actors, podcasters, or even a guy who created a company making houses out of old shipping containers, then you should come and subscribe to Creative Block, a podcast that comes out twice a month. That's not a threat. It's just a promise. Available anywhere you download podcasts.
Someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep, someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
That's true.
Eric Matthew Richardson, thank you so much for joining me here again.
Hey there, Kyle. Thank you for having me back. I like to sandwich this company talk, you know.
I know. We've had all this meat and we're back to the bread.
Right,
so.
Right. Exactly. I'm the nice, soft, white bread that encases
right.
This Sondheim sandwich.
So thank you for being that person here for me. Because you've been on here a few different times,
right?
Maybe we can start with what you've been up to since the last time you were here.
So funny thing, you bring that up. I have been up to a couple things. One was I had a 10-minute musical. I think I might have talked about this.
Yeah, you were kind of teasing that the last time you were here.
Yeah, so I had a 10-minute musical, Pigasus, about a true story that happened in Chicago about a pig that ran for president. And so that had a run with the Chicago Music Theater Festival here back in February. That was great. I'm hoping to maybe do something more with it this year. The other
when
thing,
you say something more, like expand it to be longer, or just do it again?
I don't want to. What I'm toying with is some form of digital aspect to it. Now, I don't want to come out and say exactly, because I know that that is a big undertaking. So that is something that I'm stewing on. I am wrapping up completion on my next full length that I'm hoping to have a reading of this year. And there are plans in place, but as you might be aware, there is a global pandemic going on that has Kyle, I'm sorry.
You're the first person to tell me this.
Oh my goodness, Kyle.
I've literally been asleep for 2 weeks.
You've been
not looking outside.
Too hard on this Sondheim podcast. You need to get out a little bit. Well, actually, don't get out.
To tell you a bit of a truth, I was 2 weeks ago, I went to a cabin with friends. So out in the middle of nowhere, cut off. Like, there was cell service, but I kind of just turned my phone off.
Right, right.
So I was like cut off for 3 days, and that was enough to when I turned my phone, I'm like, oh, I guess I'm not going to New York.
Yeah.
That was basically what I woke up
just
to.
Just to completely date this podcast further, today, about 2 hours ago, the governor of Illinois, where I live, just issued a stay in place or a shelter in place.
Gotcha.
So I will continue to do that. Not that I was thinking about going outside regardless, but so yeah, that has really affected not just the theater community in, you know, New York, where, you know, there was a run of company about to happen, but it's affected the theater industry all over. I know plenty of my friends have been affected. They've had shows that have been canceled or delayed to an uncertain date. I myself was working on a show that was going to be definitely an interesting thing where it was going to be an immersive show. It was going to be a retelling of the Merlin legend in a sort of Commedia dell'arte style. I was going to do some music for it, but I was going to work closely with the actors to develop it with them. So sort of a something new for me where I hadn't actually done like devised music before. I'd composed for devised theater, but I hadn't really facilitated that devising. So I would have, you know, workshopped with them some lyrics, that sort of thing. So that was the plan, but that has since been canceled. So, yeah, uncertain on how this is going to end, how things are going to bounce back.
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, even here in Calgary, not that our theater scene is necessarily as big as it is in Chicago, definitely not as big as it is in New York City, Weirdly, though, as I've been getting more and more into the theater community here, it's amazing how many new theater companies have popped up in our little city here over the last couple of years. That just being said, it's like, yeah, like people are being laid off for a temporary amount of time, whatever that means. Things are being canceled, postponed, that sort of thing. Actually, originally, what was supposed to be happening is I was supposed to be seeing Cabaret tonight.
Oh, wow.
After we finished recording this. Of course, that's now not happening at all. So, yeah, like what my hope is that after this, that there is kind of this reinvigoration of theater and art when people can actually go out and congregate again in groups, you know, larger than two.
Right. And I think that is a definite possibility in that we're going to be cooped up for so long. I think there's going to be a desperation for that sort of communal aspect of especially with media. I know like there's sort of the threat of, you know, Netflix in regards to the theater. I mean, that's I would say the theater's primary competitor is Netflix because it's a lot easier to stay at home and watch anything as opposed to going out, going to a theater, participating in this sort of, I mean, as an audience member, you are still participating in the theater. You know, it's not a passive experience for the audience member. You are sort of being active in that engagement. And I think people are going to be sort of desperate for that communal aspect when we're coming out of this. Now, I don't know what this means for the smaller theater companies. There's some that can stay afloat. The project I was just talking about that was with, it was a smaller to mid-level company called Otherworld here that specializes in a lot of sort of sci-fi genre sort of productions where while they are smaller, they have a very dedicated fan base that is very rabid about those productions. So I think they will be fine. But, you know, I have some other friends who are, you know, they have theater companies their own that it's a question. And I believe that theater is going to survive. It's just a matter of what it's going to look like when we come out on the other side. Yeah.
What form is it and how do we encourage people to come back out? I do actually agree that now that people are essentially forced to be in their homes all day long, I think that there is something that they're seeing, whether it is live theater, film, whatever, music, concerts. There is something special when it is, hey, there's a group of people here experiencing this rather than me just sitting on my couch watching it at home.
Right.
You can't really, I don't know, pretend to have that communal experience when you don't.
Yeah, it's something that you can't replicate, you know, as you can film as many theatrical productions as possible. You can have as many, you know, movie adaptations, but it doesn't have the danger of something being live. You know, it doesn't have the communal aspect of getting together in a group of people and reacting together to something. So I know this is sort of getting away from the topic at hand, but it is affecting a lot of us. And I'm curious to see how things change going forward.
This is not me trying to be like, I don't know. This is not me trying to white knight or anything like this. Right. I will say, you know, I had my New York City trip planned. I had bought tickets to four different shows. Mm-hmm. And two of them were like really good at just being like, well, I say good. They were so quick to offer me a refund that I didn't even have the option of saying, well, like, I don't need a refund necessarily. That was like Company and The Minutes. I was going to go see the play The Minutes by Tracy Letts. Both of them literally issued me refunds and said, like, we're refunding your ticket. The other two, I was going to go to Roundabout Theater to see Caroline or Change.
Okay.
And this other, like, really off-Broadway one-man show that someone had told me about, a show called I Am Nobody.
Interesting.
Anyways, both of those, there was the option of saying, you can donate your ticket to the theater. And that's what I chose to do because they're, like, super... well, smaller theaters or, like, they get by just because of donations and stuff. Right. They're not... backed by millions and millions of dollars.
Those off-Broadway institutions that are, you know, less financially sound than they may appear.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast were either planning on attending or definitely highly anticipating that production of Company that has now canceled a certain amount of performances, but who knows what's going to happen to that? I mean, it really depends
on how much this stretches out, right? Like how long...
And I mean, the producers are the ones that are, you know, responsible for the longevity of a show. And if it doesn't have the chance to make any money right out the bat, I mean, I'm not I don't know what's going to happen 2 months from now when Broadway starts back up again. If that's the time we're looking at, there are many questions regarding this. There was that other production of Assassins that was going to go up too, and you know, it's who's to say what's going on with that? I don't know. It's a strange time.
It's a very strange time.
I mean, I did have the thought of there was a period where who's the super producer? Scott, is it Rudin?
Scott Rudin?
Yeah, Rudin. He slashed all his ticket prices to like $50 or something, and so everyone was trying to follow suit, and I had the thought in the back of my head where I'm like, should I? Like, I'm young, I can take this thing, but I decided against it.
Yeah, that's good. I will say this is probably the greatest time that I started work on my musical, Don't Cough on Me! Exclamation point, the musical. So,
yeah.
Really lucked into that one.
I'm sure we're
going
to get a lot of just utterly fantastic
corona-related... Like, shut-in or something like that, yeah. Two-handers, like people just locked into place. Well, we're here to talk about being alive, funny enough, so let's continue being alive.
Yeah.
As we get into talking about this song, this is like the ultimate song, this is what everything is leading up to in this show, and is like the closer of the show, sung by the three different people that we're focusing on in here. So the original Broadway cast, it is Dean Jones. We are talking also about the 2006 revival starring Raul Esparza, and of course the London revival starring Rosalie Craig. All of them have a chance to sing this song. But what I wanted to start off talking about is the fact that this was not the original choice to end the show. There was two other options, or three other options, depending on who you say, because some people say that originally they wanted to have Marry Me a Little be in this place.
I've heard that as well, yeah.
But I couldn't get necessarily multiple sources saying that, so, but for sure, according to Sondheim himself, the first one was called Multitude of Amys.
Multitudes of Amys crowd the streets below. Avenues of Amys, office fulls of Amys, everywhere I go. Wonder what it means. Oh, I wonder what it means. I see them waiting for the lights, running for the bus, milling in the stores, inhaling cabs and disappearing through revolving doors. Multitudes of Amys.
And the second one was called Happily Ever After.
Someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep, someone to love you too hard, happily ever after. Someone to need you too much, someone to read you too well, someone to bleed you of all the things you don't want to tell. That's happily ever after, ever, ever, ever after in hell.
Now, I know because we talked about it very briefly before we started recording, you have heard both of these.
I have heard both of these, yes.
Do you think they made the right choice, ultimately, of picking Being Alive?
Yeah, I think they did. I know. Sure. Sondheim says that, I think it's Multitude of Amys that he has a soft spot for.
Yeah,
and it is in the same vein as Being Alive. It has the same emotional heft, I think. I think they made a good choice in not having Multitude of Amys because... I believe that was when the ending was he was going to propose to Amy.
Yeah, it would be a very different show, I think, with that in its place. And this would also make Marry Me a Little not even happen in the in the first act.
Right.
It would not make sense to be there.
And it's interesting to know how much they were waffling with the ending for so long. Granted, it's a more experimental show. It's more about the idea of marriage or cohabitating or letting someone into your life rather than, you know, a distinct plot development. So I can understand why maybe they were being more gestural with things and then the ending was sort of an afterthought. But on the other hand, I feel like you never want to like dive in too deep with a show until you know where you're going to end up. So it's interesting that they had like multiple songs that they had tried out that completely changed the ending of the show in some regard.
Oh, for sure. And like even if we go to Happily Ever After, don't let that title fool you. It is a very dark song.
It is.
To end off the show
with. It's very, I don't know how to put this. It is very much not my favorite Sondheim song.
What do you mean by that?
There's something about, I can't tell if it's like the melodic content or what. It just doesn't feel like A, an ending, and B, it doesn't, it almost sounds like someone trying to write a Sondheim song.
Oh,
it's almost like a parody of a Sondheim song where it's like a little too complex. I can't really tell. But there's something about it that just seems off to me. That's why I think Multitude of Amy's sort of fits better as like, that sounds like an ending, like an emotional ending. And of course, Being Alive is the best out of all of them. Even if Marry Me a Little was supposed to go here, which I could see, still has the same feel as Being Alive or Multitude of Amy's, whereas Happily Ever After, I'm not sure what sort of feel he was going for. It was almost like completely blasé to the whole thing, you know?
It almost feels this is like Multitude of Amy's to me, even having listened to a version of it, is like this person falling in love and like, I see Amy everywhere and now I need to ask her to marry me. And then Happily Ever After is almost like the complete inverse of that, which is like all this relationship stuff. Bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, I hate it.
Yeah.
And it is definitely a take. Like, it is a very kind of pessimistic look on relationships. I just don't feel like that would feel as honest. And I know Sondheim would actually absolutely disagree with me because he feels Being Alive isn't necessarily a very honest take to the Bobby character. But it would feel like we've seen him go through all of these different short pieces and people giving him advice and him almost getting to that revelation. And then Being Alive is finally that breaking forth. Like, okay, I get it. This is, I know what I actually want now.
Whereas Happily Ever After is more of just like, oh, that's the same thing we've seen this whole, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah, like it's like all the disaffected couples like have, or some of the disaffected couples have like gotten through to him. Like in this refrain here, he's like, get a little car, take a little drive, make a little love, see a little flick, do a little work, take a little walk, watch a little TV, and click, make a little love, do a little work, get a little drunk. You've got one little trip, 70 years, spread it around.
So quick. Get a little car, take a little drive, make a little love, see a little flick, do a little work, take a little walk, watch a little TV, and click, make a little love, do a little work, get a little drunk, you've got one little trip, 70 years, spread it around, take your...
So it's just like, ooh, okay, so it's like... Your monotony of 70 years, like that's what relationships are. I actually do feel in a way, this might be very true to the way that Sondheim felt at 30, whatever.
Yes.
No, he would have been, 30, whatever he would have been at this point in time. However old he was in 1970.
He might have been older.
Actually, he might have been late 30s at this point. Yeah. But to his point, like he didn't really like, quote unquote, fall in love or have a relationship really until his 60s.
Right.
So it feels like that almost juvenile look at what relationships can be.
Mm-hmm.
Apologies because I'm bringing in his personal life, which I know sometimes he doesn't like.
Right.
But still, it's like, I feel that that has some effect to the stuff that you're writing.
Yeah, and an interesting thing to me that's like, obviously, when you read these lyrics to Happily Ever After, they are so closely connected with Being Alive. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like you get into them and like there's like direct ripoffs. Like I believe the very first opening lines of Happily Ever After are someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep, someone to love you too hard, happily ever after.
Yeah. And this song that clearly was the progenitor of Being Alive. And yet those two songs have completely different meanings, you know? So it's interesting to see the sentiments of Happily Ever After flipped on its head when we get to Being Alive without much of a change. Shows the importance of a first draft, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I like to open this up very briefly before we jump into the actual lyrics themselves. I find this the kind of fascinating thing about musical theater, and you're probably a good person to talk to about this, which is in very few art forms you have something like this, where it's like, this is three attempts to like end this off.
Mm-hmm.
Like rock albums, pop albums. Yes, you can like rearrange songs in the LP. You might drop songs here and there. but never are you being like, well, this is my third try to be the ending song of this album. And right. Whereas in theater, it's like sometimes you can go through a few iterations, or if we jump all the way back to A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Farm, like this show doesn't work unless we have this like really strong opening. So let's go through four tries to try and nail this down. I don't know. Have you come across something similar to this in your own work?
I mean, yeah, like trying to crack the one song for the moment that you need. Absolutely. Right. I think there's, on the show I'm working on now, there's like one particular moment that I probably generated. I didn't quite get to a complete song like this, but I did generate like probably four different complete ideas. Before I'm like, this is what I think needs to be here. Now, it's always, you're always going to be uncertain. But to answer your question, why this happens, particularly in theater as opposed to like making an album, is most importantly, narrative and emotion, right? The reason why people sing in musicals is to convey something that normal text cannot. So if you don't have the song that conveys the specific emotion you're trying to convey, then you're going to have a problem. You know, if you make a very happy song and you fill it with sort of, I don't know, ironic, morose lyrics, sometimes that's not going to translate. I know it's very clever, but it's not really going to land the same way. And I think that's maybe what the issue is with Happily Ever After, where I don't think, I mean, they were going for a completely different tone for that ending, right?
Well, yeah, and like that's the fight, quote unquote, that broke out. Like Hal Prince was like, this is too much of a downer. We cannot right. end our show about relationships with our main lead being like, yeah, screw it.
Right.
So I think maybe Sondheim has held a little bit of a beef ever since that time.
Yeah.
If I wanted to like look into it a little bit more. But even to his description, I think he calls this, let me just actually find the exact thing that he says. Something, and then it goes into a prayer, is what he says. So he wanted it to progress from complaint to a prayer. That's what he kind of describes being alive being. It's like, fine, this is what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And then finally kind of resolving into like, no, like this is actually what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
He almost comes to that realization during the song.
Right. And I think part of it too, you know, why maybe he was so holding on to Happily Ever After is that it is the more like compositionally interesting of the two. I think Being Alive seems like it's so easy to come out, you know, it's not like it's not doing anything particularly clever on an intellectual level. Whereas Happily Ever After, you know, there's like these quick little snippets. It's a little more rhythmically interesting. However, that doesn't mean that that's going to be emotionally satisfying, you know. It's that
that's right.
I like Being Alive, I think, is the perfect song for this situation, and it conveys so much more without being an intellectual puzzle that you need to solve. So I think that's part of it. I think it's something that everyone struggles with when you're a composer. You want to do this thing that is impressive. You want to do this thing that is artistically satisfying to you. But sometimes that's not always interesting to other people or needed.
So depending on the version of Being Alive that you listen to, definitely the original Broadway cast starts off with that refrain that we've heard so much throughout the show, where the cast is singing like, Bobby, Bobby, baby, Bobby, Bobby. Like, that's how they open it up.
Mm-hmm.
Little side note that might mean absolutely nothing to nobody. In the Raul Esparza version, it's just like this little string melody that's getting played.
Right.
That reminds me so much of Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And I'm going to insert it here to see if anyone else can pick up on it. I don't know why. It always makes me think of that when that starts.
Could you sing it to me so I can maybe...
Sorry, that's a Song of Time. I don't want to turn like,
oh,
things
okay.
back. It's going to
yeah,
go all
kerplooey. Yeah, you're going to go back. You're going to be a kid again. I understand.
So after they sing that, Robert comes out and says, someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep, someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep. And this is when some of the cast comes in and Paul says, that's true, but there's more than that. Sarah says, is that all you think there is to it? Harry says, you've got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't got one good reason for being alone. And then Larry says, come on, you're onto something, Bobby, you're onto something.
Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
That's true, but there's more than that.
Is that all you think there is to it?
You've got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't got one good reason for being alone.
Come on, you're onto something, Bobby. You're onto something.
This always, again, depends on the staging of the creative director and that sort of thing. Often this is done when he is still at the birthday party.
Right.
So, like, he's thinking about blowing out the candles again, and these characters are all around him giving him advice and stuff like that. But what do you think? Like, we start off with him singing a lyric and then these interjections going on. What point do you find the interjections play in this song?
I mean, again, this completely relies on the staging. But if I were doing this, I don't think this isn't happening in real time. He's not singing these things to the people at his birthday party. I think that they are more manifestations of himself. It's almost like his inner thoughts leading him along. Maybe a conscience, maybe just like a general mental state that he's in that's leading him this way. But yeah, in my head, it's more of the idea of the phrases being said, not so much these specific people are telling him things.
And something I should have actually mentioned here at the beginning too is that it's not written down in the lyrics in the book, Finishing the Hat. But every version starts off with Bobby asking that question, what do you get?
Right.
Right? And I think that that is sometimes, in a way, the question that these interjections are going through.
Mm-hmm.
That Bobby is so focused still, even to this point, of what do I get out of this, of having a relationship in the first place?
Yeah.
And I think we see a little bit of him turning the corner of even asking that question or phrasing it that way. How about the actual lyrics themselves, which is someone to hold you too close, to hurt you too deep, sit in your chair. Do you think those are all related, or are those three separate thoughts?
Hold you too close leads into hurt you too deep.
Yeah.
In that you are, I mean, I think what he's saying is you're, when you allow someone into your life,
yeah,
they have the possibility of hurting you too much, right? And then the sit in your chair and ruin your sleep are related in my mind, where it's these are the annoyances of having someone around, not so much the dangers, right? So I think the first two are much more, it's almost like much more personalized to him, and he's bearing himself a lot more. And then those second two lines are more flippant.
Yeah, which is, sit in my chair, ruin my sleep.
Yeah,
that sort
it's
of
an
thing.
Interesting psychological turn, I think. And but yeah, I think it's just something about this opening. These opening four lines are just like perfect. It's like you get exactly what he's saying immediately, and he's not saying much.
That's right. Like, and again, this goes back to my love of Sondheim in general, which is he's able to use simple language to express such complicated feelings.
Right.
Not that he's the only person who can do that, but he's one of the best people of just like cutting me right down to my core with like just a simple phrase. Like, oh, yeah, no, I get that. I've been there. I understand exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
He goes on saying, someone to need you too much, someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell. And then Joanne says, you're not a kid anymore, Robert. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo. And then Peter says, hey, buddy, don't be afraid it won't be perfect. The only thing to be afraid of, really, is that it won't be. And then Jenny says, don't stop now. Keep going.
Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell. You see what you look for, you know?
You're not a kid anymore, Bobby. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo.
Hey, buddy, don't be afraid that it won't be perfect. The only thing to be afraid of, really, is that it won't be.
Don't stop now. Keep going.
Someone you
need you too much, know you too well, pull you up short, put you through hell. those four lines specifically. Do you feel like that's kind of the same as the beginning one, or are we starting to...
I think he's getting more antagonistic towards it as it goes on. Mm-hmm. I think at the beginning, he's sort of wading into the water, and now he's convincing himself. Especially the put you through hell is like such charged language compared to the others. A, I think that's sort of, again, pulled from Happily Ever After. And B, I think it's more about like anger towards the situation,
yeah.
Rather than brushing it off, right? It's like almost being more definitive and like hateful towards the idea of marriage rather than just being like, oh, that's not for me.
Yeah, I think that there has been different guests here this season who have had different responses to the role of Esparza's version specifically, but I've always found his, you know, version of this song to be like this simmering anger. Like he starts off being like, I'm trying to keep this in control, and then it kind of spills over into anger, and then he finally kind of comes to acceptance at the very end. Dean Jones, to a little bit, I think, has the same thing in that. There is that like underlying anger, I think, that you're starting this song off in. And I don't know. I that's, if I were to be a director of this show, that's almost how I would want to try and play this. Is like there's this simmering thing. You've had all these thoughts in your mind, all these people giving you these ideas and suggestions, and this is you finally trying to wrap your head around all of that stuff. So it's, you're kind of like bursting through. Your emotions are finally being shown
right,
on stage
right,
when you've been trying to keep them in check the entire show.
Oh yeah, and there's many interpretations to Bobby, and mm-hmm. Depending on who's playing him really makes or breaks this particular song, because this relies so much on that welling up and then that release at the end. And mm-hmm. If you've played him a little too cool, sometimes it doesn't land. But then if you play it really emotionally bare, but maybe guarded, that I think that's always the one that's the money right there, you know?
You know, something I've just been noticing here, even though I've been looking at this for the past couple of days, There does seem to be a bit of a progression here, because in the first one, you know, the hold you too close, hurt you too deep, he really is talking about the other person. Like, I'm just talking about this other entity that I don't even know who that is yet. The second one, like, need you too much, know you too well, there's starting to be, like, that connection between there is a coupling here, like, there's a give and take going on. Mm-hmm. And then in this next one, when we get into, I feel it's more coming into him specifically, where it's, like, it's my actions affecting this other person.
Right.
So it's almost doing this progression from them, us, me. Like, that's how it's kind of going through it. Because he continues on, someone you have to let in, someone whose feelings you spare, someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot. And then Susan says, and what does all that mean? Larry says, Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there? And then Harry goes, it's all much better living it than looking at it, Robert. And then Peter, he says, add him up, Bobby, add him up.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
And what does all that mean?
Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there?
It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Add him up, Bobby, add him up.
Someone.
Apparently, it's supposed to be about the candles that he's about to blow out. Even though I never really knew what that meant when I was
right.
growing up listening
right.
to that.
I was figurative, like, oh, you have all the answers in front of you. You just have to add them up.
Yeah, add them
but
up.
But if
like,
it
bring
is
them up,
about the candles, yeah. Well, that's a different interpretation.
I mean, again, interpret it however you want
to. Yeah.
I think in this newest revival, they don't do it at the birthday. I think she's walking through all the different scenes she's been in
okay.
for the previous show. Like I said, I can't see it, so I don't know. But that's what I've been led to believe. What do you feel about this stanza of Robert, though? Someone to let you in, feelings you spare, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
I think it plays a lot into his self-preservation and his selfishness. Mm-hmm. I think in every relationship we've seen with him, it's always been about him, you know, and what he gets out of it. And it's never about what the other person involved feels or, you know, cares.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very telling. And it's interesting that he's not seeing it at that moment as he's saying it. But, you know, we're all blind to our own faults.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah. Sometimes you have to have that outside perspective to really see it. Oh, of course. His next one is someone to crowd you with love, someone to force you to care, someone to make you come through who always be there, as frightened as you of being alive, being alive, being alive, being alive. And then AB breaks in here, blow out your candles, Robert, and make a wish. Want something.
Someone to crowd you with love, someone to force you to care, someone to make you come through, who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive, being alive.
Want something.
I love that want something. Like my friends and I, well, my friends that are aware of this show.
Yeah.
It's something about that line I don't know why it stands out amongst the other ones, but it's just always the perfectly quotable thing to say. And people know exactly what you're talking about if they are in on the joke. And I don't know why it's that one line, but it's very funny.
Well, I think it's also said by Amy, who like early in the show does that, like you want somebody, not somebody, like right, like they emphasize a different point of the word. Right. And here it's like want something.
Right.
Yeah. So it kind of puts that different stress on different areas. By the by, for me, of course, it always goes back to Elaine Stritch, because I love how she says, "You'll never be a kid again, kiddo."
You're not a kid anymore, Robbie. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo.
It's like, I can tell you just smoked a pack of cigarettes before you came in and recorded that line. Yeah, so someone to crowd you with love. For me, this is kind of starting to be that breaking point for the character, right? Mm-hmm. Someone to crowd you with love, to force you to care, to make you come through. Like, all of these words and all of these, like, declarations that Robert is saying, for me at least, is like he's starting to kind of get it. It's like, I have been, like, super closed off. Mm-hmm. Like, through this entire show, as an audience member, we've mentioned it multiple times, like, he's just this cipher. He doesn't have, like, a lot of character, quote unquote, throughout the show. Right. So you can kind of bring your own backstory and baggage to him as much as you want, or her as much as you want. And then here it's like, okay, I have to start like being something or someone. Like, I can't just be walking through life experiencing it. I actually have to go and do some of the work.
Right. And I think that the next couple lines there, where it's who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive, I think that's that breakthrough where he starts thinking less about him, and he invites that other fictional entity, and he starts into the conversation. And he starts thinking about, oh, well, they are frightened about this too, you know, as frightened as you. And I think that's sort of that breaking point. That's where, you know, the floodgates start opening, that kind of catapult us into the next section here. But I also think the ending of this. The being alive, of being alive, mm-hmm. being alive, being alive, being alive, right?
Yeah.
That is the first time we've had a resolution of in any of these stanzas yet.
Right, he's been building and then comes back down, building and
he's always been
down.
Interrupted by these thoughts. And this is the first time he's finally resolved, and it's like a complete musical idea, which is definitely not a mistake, because of what's coming next and what changes mm-hmm. next, because things are going to change next. It does modulate up a half
step.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you this. Like, can you talk to me about, like, musically what is going on in, like, this first half of the song?
Right. So a lot of Sondheim, as rhythmically complex as it is, as lyrically complex as it is, one of his trademarks, I think, is sort of harmonic simplicity for the most part. A lot of it, I don't want to say simplicity, but I think there's this trend with a lot of Sondheim songs, and we saw this with the opening, where there's this sort of stasis, right? It feels like it's not moving from a harmonic center. It's staying on basically the same chord base for a long period of time, where it doesn't feel like there's a real change. And that's something he does a lot that's really interesting, and especially in these like longer numbers that he makes that sort of stretch time and space sometimes. That works really well. And I think in this song, he chooses to modulate up a half step, which is I think every composer has done this to bring energy into a song, especially like when you're going to that last chorus, you modulate up a half step, and you know, it's sort of a cliche. But here it's so non-cliched, and it's masked really cleverly. It's hard to describe because the orchestration changes a little bit, so it's not like you're thinking, oh, it's modulated up a half step going to that final chorus. Mm-hmm. It's more of like you sense there's a new idea being presented almost.
Right. Now, once it does that modulation, that half step up, does it stay there or does it come back
it
down
stays
to
there
its original?
Through the end of the piece, which I think not only separates these two ideas that are being presented lyrically, but also harmonically. Now, that's not something that, like, when you're sitting in the theater, you're going, oh, he is harmonically mm-hmm. presenting a new idea. No, you're feeling it on sort of a subconscious level. It's not really an active thing going on. It's not obvious that it's happening, but it's very interesting that he did intentionally do that. Because he could have easily just gone back to the starting chord and just started over.
Right.
But no, he chose to modulate up a half step to sort of bring us home.
Talking about taking us home here, so for the next half of the song that gets sung, for the first half, it's always someone, right? Someone to crowd you with love, someone to force you to care, et cetera, et cetera. It's always someone.
Mm-hmm.
But the second half changes that word to somebody.
Right.
So somebody hold me too close, somebody hurt me too deep. So any ideas of why the word change in the second half of the song?
Because it is a plea, like we talked about. It's a prayer, mm-hmm. as you said.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shout into the void, asking for anyone to come and hold him too close and hurt him too deep. Also, it's not just the object that is changing, right? It's not someone to somebody, but it's also from you to me. So instead of saying someone to crowd you with love,
right,
you know, saying a hypothetical you, now it's saying somebody hold me too close, you know?
It's like that final realization that, hey, I do actually want this.
Right, right.
This isn't something that I have to put upon myself or think of it as a grievance. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is actually, I do want this. I want this in my life. I always think it's so interesting because when I realize that I realize, okay, that's why the second half might sound slightly different, because someone, of course, is two syllables. Somebody is three syllables.
Yeah.
So you actually have to change how you write that lyric out a little bit here, too.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to call out something here before I get too far, which is, we mentioned this in these two episodes, but how much foreshadowing there is to being alive, which is so hilarious to me when I know that this was not the original end goal of this song, like the end goal of
right.
this show. It was very late in the creative process that being alive was placed into there, because someone is waiting, has like, someone will hold me, like that is one of the lines that is sung in there, and the marry me a little has love me just enough. So it's like these ideas, these lyrical phrases that are being used are now coming back and being commented on at the very end of the show.
Right.
So I think that's just really interesting.
Well, I think it's a thing that it adds a level of coherency to any show, but I think it's something that he does musically a lot, where he'll have little bits and phrases that he'll work in throughout a show.
I mean, yeah, we're gonna be doing Follies next.
Right, right.
Or there's even a lot like, of little leitmotifs
yeah,
that go
through
that.
Yeah, that's all of Into the Woods as well.
Yeah, that's true.
But he does do that with little phrases too, that like lyrically, I mean, that I think do add another level of coherency to a lot of his shows, and you know, sets him apart. It makes it feel like it congeals it. It makes it feel like it's a solid chunk of theater rather than like, oh, here's these individual set pieces, if that makes sense.
Robert continues on, Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive, being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive. Being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me alive.
So this is the part of the song which always gives me goosebumps when when I listen to it, because it is like, it's almost like that righteous anger that they're now singing with it. Like, no, like, I want this thing. Like, give me this hell. Make me a person. Like, a part of me, I know, gets onto a little bit of a soapbox with this song in a way, which is, I totally get that not every single person out there, like, needs a relationship in their life to feel whole. But as someone who's identified themselves, like, yeah, like, a relationship is something, like, that is a goal and a want of mine and a need of mine.
Right.
This hits so close to home. It's like, no, I want this in my life. It's not just a matter of me having something, an object. It's like this give and take. It's this person that's in my life that's going to hold me accountable, that will, like, push me to become better, to make me human, to make me alive. Like, there's that whole idea that's wrapped up into these lyrics.
I mean, relationships are always scary. There's always... You never quite feel like you're always going to be on solid ground, you know, just because you're two humans, and humans have different wants and needs. And so,
and let's be fair, humans are stupid. So.
Humans are surprisingly stupid and surprisingly selfish. And
right. I do have like a whole flat of toilet paper in my house, though, just so you know.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the recent pandemic has proven this to be true.
That's right.
Now imagine inviting all those people into your home. but yeah, I think it's such a specific worry to try to capture in a song, right? It's such a specific fear that everyone has, you know, about... It's not just saying like, oh, I'm afraid of a relationship. It's like specifying exactly the fears that you have regarding a relationship, you know? And I think that's why it resonates so much. And I think it's something that frustrates me about Sondheim is his sort of like resistance to talking about this song. I have watched as much as I can about Sondheim talking about, you know, his, you know, pieces and stuff that, you know, he writes. And something about this is just like, there's nothing. He like does, even in his book here, he doesn't say a lot about the song. Even in Six by Sondheim.
He kind of dismisses this and like throws it away.
Right. And then he talks a little bit about his relationship slightly and moves on. So it's something that I think probably even scares him a little. Going back to sort of that idea of capturing this moment, I think we talked a little bit about it earlier. I know that we have these three productions that we're sort of sifting through, but there's one version of this that I think really captures the spirit of the song in a way that I've been searching for a long time, that I feel like obviously they're all great. I love Raul Esparza's version. I haven't seen the new one, and again, I haven't seen the original, but I've seen the recording. But it's the Donmar Warehouse version from, I think, 95 or 6. It was
Sam 95
Mendes.
Or 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
just so people know, you can kind of find it on YouTube if you want.
Yes, you maybe can find it on YouTube. Now, I will give a disclaimer that the Robert in that production is not the greatest singer. I forget the actor's name, but the reason why I bring up that particular production of this song is because this moment of being alive, again, he's not the greatest singer, but it is the most emotionally charged version I think I've seen ever. And there's something about the way he enters the song, and it's already sort of tinged with sadness in a way that I haven't seen some of the other productions do. But when he gets to this moment, he just completely lets loose. And it's one of the most moving versions of this song that I've seen.
Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with...
And it's sort of hard to top for me. I think that's what I've always wanted out of it, is sort of a Bobby that is finally bearing his soul rather than continuing that sort of cool attitude into this, you know?
For sure. Just so we don't blow past it, Adrian Lester is the actor's name.
Oh, thank you.
Who is
thank
in you. That production. But no, I agree. Like, I think this is one of those songs, and I wouldn't say like every Sondheim song follows this path, although he has a lot of examples of this, which is that in some ways, if you are not a strong singer, sometimes it makes it a little bit better.
Right.
That little bit of struggling that goes on. I forget where I heard it. It was a different podcast, but they always said that that's why they like Patti LuPone as Evita more than anyone else, because she's struggling to hit those notes. There's a little bit of danger that's there. Instead of someone who sings at this perfectly from start to finish.
Well, there's also, I think it's also just a personal preference where the stuff that I write and what the kind of people I like to cast are people who are better actors than they are singers. I like a very realistic sort of... I prefer like an extension of your natural voice rather than like the Broadway sound. So it's just something that I'm attracted to. I think it carries a little more emotional weight. Now, other people disagree. Other people think that like a perfect, you know, Broadway voice, that's going to pack a more emotional punch. And I'm not saying that's wrong. Sure. It's just
different styles.
It doesn't
different...
float my boat in the same way.
That's right.
At this point in the song, we no longer have those interjections.
Where they've all kind of gone away.
Yeah, so we've gone through two stanzas here, and where there would normally be the interjections from his friends, they have since disappeared.
Have you seen the movie Marriage Story?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. That's a good example of...
another good example of someone who might not be like the strongest singer.
Right.
Why am I forgetting his name?
Adam Driver.
Adam Driver, thank you. When
his
Adam Driver
Kylo
sings...
Ren.
I know, when Kylo Ren sings Being Alive, that would have made the Last Star Wars movie better. But,
I wouldn't disagree.
But you know, when there's that moment, and some people find it a little bit goofy, I don't know, it was pretty affecting for me watching the movie, but I also have the baggage of knowing where the song is and like the history of it, that sort of thing.
I know there was, there was word, I don't know if this was confirmed or if I just read this, that it was Marriage Story started as like an adaptation of Company at some point.
Yes. Yeah, that's the rumor. And I kind of want to see what Noah Baumbach's version of Company would be. I don't know. There's some interesting things that would be there.
That's interesting, because I don't think I would want to see Noah Baumbach's. Yeah. Well, maybe I would for a certain type of watch, but I don't know. I think...
it'd be very different.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't the only Sondheim song in there, so you could tell that there was still... semblances of that. He used it in a very specific moment that is almost the opposite meaning of the song in some regard, because it was about a divorce. Spoiler alert, Marriage Story was about a divorce.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was almost like coming from someone on the other side of a marriage.
Make me confused, mock me with praise. Let me be used, vary my days, but alone is alone, not alive. Somebody cry.
Where I think that the going through the divorce makes people feel like they're not human, like their value has been like drawn out of them, right. And that's why he's singing "Being Alive." I agree with that. He's singing it at a very different point.
Yeah, it was almost like a regretful perspective, right? Like he was like, "Oh, I wish I could still hold on to that feeling," whereas mm-hmm. this is more like, "I wish I could feel that feeling."
That feeling in the first place, yeah, so. For sure. This is also where the music behind the singer is now really ramping up. Correct. Like we're really going for it here. This is how the song ends: "Make me confused, mock me with praise, let me be used, vary my days, but alone is alone. Not alive. Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody let me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive, being alive, being alive.
Make me confused. Mock me with praise. Let me be used. Vary my day. Alone is alone, not alive. Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive, being alive, being alive.
We did it.
We did it. We got here. So a couple of things before we get into that ending, because I think there's some really interesting word choices that are put into this very final bit. First one being this. I like how every actor has a very different reading of "mock me with praise."
Oh, yes.
Some people really like go into that mock word, like mock.
Have you ever seen those Broadway supercuts that people have made of like different productions of like the same where they, you know, edit, they like there's one of my friends don't ask me from Les Mis. I really want one. There might be one of "mock me with praise." I would love to see everyone's interpretation of "mock me with praise." It just, oh, it's so good. It's hard to beat Raul Esparza on that one.
Yeah, he really goes for it.
"Mock me with praise."
But what I really want to bring up, and I alerted you to this at the before we started recording, but I didn't tell you when it was going to happen. There is a lyric change that only the original Broadway cast sings it this way. So, as written in the book "Finishing the Hat" by Stephen Sondheim, it says, "Somebody let me come through," right? That's the third thing he says. "Somebody crowd me with love, force me to care, and then let me come through." Every recording is "let me come through," except for the original Broadway cast. They don't say "let me come through." They say "make me come through."
Interesting.
And I think that totally changes the meaning of that line.
That does.
Versus "let" and then "make." So one is like forcing you, one is like bringing you, like pulling versus push.
It also sort of changes the entire meaning of "come through." I think like "let me come through" sort of implies like allow me to enter, right? Whereas "make me come through," it almost implies like force me to be there, right? Like that sort of version of "come through." I don't know why that changes it in my mind. Like, you know, he's going to come through for you sort of thing. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder for which reason he changed the lyric. I'm assuming it's the first that you said, where it's, you know.
I think the "let" makes more sense to the meaning behind the song.
And it's also an interesting thing. Like, what a very minor change to enact. Yeah. I know he likes to fiddle with his shows post production, and it's such an oddly specific change that does change the meaning. Yeah, that's interesting.
Where I want to know is like when it happened. I don't even know if the London version had a recording done, like the first London version. There probably is somewhere out there. I wonder if that is as soon as he made the change or if it was afterwards that he did it. Because, of course, Dean Jones sings it that way. But if you got certain copies of the company original Broadway cast, they include another version of Being Alive sung by Larry Kurt, who actually came on after Dean Jones left. There's a big thing with this production where Dean Jones was actually only there for a very short time and then left because, and I apologize, he was some type of Christian that wasn't feeling comfortable with like some of the subject matter that was in the show. So Larry Kurt replaced him. Larry Kurt was actually able to be nominated for a Tony that year.
Oh, wow.
When normally they don't let people who come on after the run be considered. You'll remember Larry Kurt, by the way, as being the original Tony from West Side Story,
there
for those
you
of you keeping a score at home.
Before we move on, this is another like weird thing that pops out to me is funny a lot about this song is the way Dean Jones sings "But Alone is Alone, Not Alive." He just chews it so weird.
Yeah.
It's like you're never sure what vowel is going to come out next. It's so good. I love it.
For me, actually, the biggest one is to help us survive.
Yes.
Like that line right there is like, yes, like this is what we've been all driving for. He's finally come to this realization that it's not a me versus them. It's an us situation.
It's the first time he said us in this entire song as well.
Yeah, first time he said us in the entire song, probably in the entire show, too, if we really broke it down that way. But anything else that really jumps out at you from like these final lyrics?
From the final half here, I like the recapitulation of the lyrics from the first section, sort of, you know, mirroring what his original thoughts were, and now he's expounding on them. I do like the B section here that we did not have in that first section. I'm going to call it the someone section and the somebody section. So the someone section, it's just the same idea repeated over and over, sort of broken up by these interjections. Now, this somebody section, the second half, after it modulates, we go into sort of like a different song form where we have, I would say the original is more like an A-A-A-A, like just sort of the same thing repeated. Then this second half has that sort of a more traditional song form, like the 32-bar Broadway song form of A-A-B-A, where we have this B section that really Sondheim utilizes to really drive that emotional heft home. It's not like a thoughtful, pensive B section. It's like a very brash, in your face. The language is very commanding. You know, make me confused, mock me with praise, let me be used, vary my days. It's not wasted, you know. So it's interesting to see this the form of the song take on a different form. in that second half.
Musically, of course, we're getting like, I don't know, it's like every instrument and horn and everything is just being thrown at this thing, I feel,
at
the very end.
And I think there's a callback to Company, the opening. There's like a little counter melody playing above. It's like, da 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 da.
That's right.
Playing above, I think that last stanza there, the somebody crowd me with love. So it's just one of those things that ties everything together again.
Yeah, it's all tied together in a nice little bow at the very, very end. I don't know, like, what final thoughts do you have about this? Like, thematically, does this feel like a wrap-up of everything that's been talked to us or been shown to us throughout the night? Is this an actual coda, or is this, like, leaving something open that has not been resolved?
I think it's both. So I'm going to share my frustrations with the show towards the end of this.
Sure.
So I think this is a resounding ending to the show, right? This is like, Robert has changed. We don't quite know what he's going to do, though, right? We don't know what his next move is. I know there were talks of him proposing to Amy, or there's supposedly a production out there where he commits suicide, which is insane.
Makes no sense, but okay. Yeah.
But it does feel like, oh, this is the end of his arc, right? He's finally broken through, and here is this resounding ending. And unfortunately, here is my gripe with this show. It continues. There is, for some reason, this show does not
more
end with
play
a song
at the end of this.
Yeah, it ends with some talking that we don't need because this says everything it needs to say. So I wish that at some point in the future, we're going to get a production of this show that just ends at the end of being alive.
Right here.
Ends on a nice big button, and it's sort of like a question of what's happening next, but at least there's that energy to end a show, you know?
Yeah. Even like in the original Broadway cast, the final, final song is just a reprise of like, we love, like that.
Yeah, I know that there were, they do that. There were a couple other finale stuff, I think, that have been either excised or I'm not sure if they're still in it. And, you know, it's some
production. No other production I've seen has included that ending. So I think, yeah, it's been completely removed. It's like being alive, like play portion, and then we're out.
Yeah, but I don't who wants this to end on a play portion? Who wants the more talking? I mean, I guess it, I know the 2006 he goes and blows up the candle. I don't know what happens in the current one, and I guess we'll never find out, maybe. And I know this is an experimental show. It pushed, you know, a lot of boundaries with the form, and this is one of those things that it pushed. You know, it didn't end with the closing song.
Do you have a sense of why you think this song in particular has stood the test of time? I mean, this kind of became a semi-standard. Like, there's been a lot of versions of this. A lot of people have done recordings of this, but much more so than any other song that's in this show. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
It's because it plays so specifically into a fear that hadn't, I'm not sure if it had been expressed, but just not to the point that this does. And I think it hasn't quite been expressed to the same level since, but it's just such a common fear of everyone, right? What is a relationship? Does a person ever really know me? Is there a danger to allowing someone to know me? And that you want that despite of those fears, you know? We're so desperate for connection that we sort of set aside those fears of being hurt because of them, you know? That's what this whole show is about. It's like what we do for relationships. I mean, Robert has seen the ills of every relationship that his friends are in, right? He's seen essentially the worst of all of his friends, and yet he still longs for it. So it's sort of this irrational idea that all of us have. It's like we do desperately want that stability, that other person there with us, in spite of the assurance that something is going to go wrong with it, you know?
Do you have a favorite recording? Is there any one that you'd like the most out of all the ones you've heard?
I just love that Raul Esparza one, mostly for the orchestrations. I feel like I'm so attracted to that show in general because it's so not of the 70s, whereas the original is very 60s, 70s pop. And then the latest one sort of goes back to that a little bit, and it's less show toony, it's less Broadway sound. So yeah, it's something about that 2006 version that's very very interesting, that and I think it sort of seems more timeless than the others.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I really like that Raul Esparza version a lot. And yet, because I'm such a nerd for like original Broadway cast recordings, it seems like that's the one that I tend to listen to the most. But I don't know, it's a good show. I like I like the songs in it, so it's hard to like really screw it up here for me. Let's end with, well, we have a couple last things to do here, but I want to read out of the book Finishing the Hat. This is how Sondheim finishes the chapter after he's written out the lyrics to Being Alive. He says, Chekhov wrote, "If you're afraid of loneliness, don't marry." Luckily, I didn't come across that quote till long after Company had been produced. Chekhov said in 7 words what it took George and me 2 years and 2.5 hours to say less profoundly. If I'd read that sentence, I'm not sure we would have dared to write the show, and we might have been denied the exhilarating experience of exploring what he said for ourselves. So I find that interesting, where it's like, I don't necessarily disagree with like that phrase being a little bit of a sum up of what's being told. At the same time, to throw out this entire like exploration of relationships in the musical theater format seems like a gross overstatement.
Right. I think part of it, I can see where he's coming from, where if he had read that, he would probably have that idea sitting in the back of his head, where so much of this show is trying to wade through these murky waters, trying to get to a resolution. And if he had already had that sentence in the back of his head, I don't know if he would have had as much wading through the waters, you know?
Yeah.
That journey to that point is the show. It's not the ending, you know?
Yeah, to me, it actually goes to another phrase it said in another Sondheim show, right? If you look at Sunny in the Park with George, it's like, I haven't said anything that hasn't been said before. And then Dot says, but said by you, though, George. Like, she, like, yeah, pushes him. It's like, yeah, yes, this has been said before, but you have not discovered that, or, like, told it from your point of view. Right. So I think there is a value to still adding things on, even though it's been said before.
It's interesting you bring up Sunny in the Park with George, because there's something about being alive that I think, in my head, it's just, like, this weird psychological connection with Sunday in the Park with George. Mm-hmm. And specifically, it's Move On. And I'm not sure why those two. I mean, there's something about the idea of sort of wading into uncomfortable relational territory, as well as like figuring something out in the moment. That's a complex feeling or an idea. Yeah, it's something about this moment and that show that are linked in my brain that I continues to confound me for why things are linked.
Well, I think for both of them, they are this, like, not titanic shift, but, you know, there's this movement that goes through them. And one, it's like, oh, I'm finally understanding what type of relationship I'm looking for, that I'm even open to that idea. Whereas the other one is like, I'm going towards this artistic outpouring, like I'm moving past like this block that I've had. So both of them are like,
right,
just get over your hangups and like move to the next thing in your life.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to see that, because I think that's every creator's maybe worry, is that the more you make, the more of yourself you're showing, which is sort of scary, right? And I mm-hmm. think the fact that we're seeing these sort of echoes throughout Sondheim's career probably gets closer to his actual self than he might be comfortable with. But, you know, that's right, why people make art at all. Is to express themselves in ways that, you know, they're not comfortable doing verbally.
Well, I think you've been on before to do this, if I remember properly, but I think it's time to play a game again,
oh,
which is How Many Tonys?
Oh.
So,
I should have prepared. I feel like,
how many Tony Awards do you think the original version of Company was nominated for? Yeah, let's first with nominated.
Okay, let's think. I feel like this was his breakout,
mm-hmm.
and this was his first critical success, so I'm gonna go with a higher number.
Yes.
This includes like a best actor, actress.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all the different awards that you could be up for.
All right, I'm gonna go with a reasonable 7.
Well, before I reveal the real number,
okay,
you're wrong, by the
I
way.
I figured I would. Is it higher?
Oh, it's way higher.
I figured. Okay.
This held, for the longest time, the most nominations of any show of all time.
Really? Wait, what,
yes.
What was it going up against? Could you tell me that?
Yeah, the No-No Nanette and the Rothschilds were the only other two
all
big
right. Well,
musicals.
See, if you had led with that, I think I would have guessed
maybe,
far so. Higher. I'm going to double it. I'm going to say 14.
Okay, you would have hit it right on the head then.
Oh, hey, look at that.
So 14 is what it was nominated for, and it held that record for over 30 years. Do you remember the show that knocked it off its pedestal?
For over 30 years, 70 to 2000,
mm-hmm.
Producers.
Yeah, Producers got 15.
Producers swept that year, I remember that.
Yeah, and then Hamilton got 16, so it's okay. Currently the one that holds the record. So, out of those 14,
all right,
how many do you think it won?
Well, I mean, it was going up against the juggernaut of the Rothschilds. So I'm going to say, I don't want to be headstrong and say 14. So I'm going to go with 10.
So here's the weird thing.
No way.
It won 6.
Whoa.
Yeah, it won 6.
Okay.
So it won not a single of the acting categories.
Okay.
What it did win for was best scenic design. You know, that elevator in the middle. You have to give it to them. Won best director for Hal Prince. Stephen Sondheim won his first two Tonys for this show.
Oh, he won.
Because it was the, I think, first and only time, or one of the few times where they actually separated best music and best lyrics into two separate categories.
Okay. And the winner is Stephen Sondheim. It's odd how there's never been a Tony Award for an orchestrator. And there's no score on Broadway that exists without orchestration. And in my opinion, the most brilliant orchestrations ever made in the musical theater are those of Jonathan Tunick for Company. And I want to share this with him.
And was orchestration a thing then?
Not yet. Okay. No. Okay. So best lyrics and best score both went to Stephen Sondheim. Best book went to George Firth, and then it won best musical that year. What it did not win for was best lighting design. That went to Paul Sills Story Theater. We all remember that great show. It did not win for best choreography. That went to No Nanette.
I thought that that tap number surely would have.
You would have thought. Best featured actress. This is where it gets hard because I think people may have canceled each other out here. So for best featured actress, Barbara Barry and Pamela Myers were both nominated, and they both lost to Patsy Kelly for No Nanette.
Classic case of splitting the vote.
Exactly.
That's the Oscar betting. That's where you fail, you know?
Best featured actor was Charles Kimbrough, but he lost to Keane Curtis for The Rothschilds. The best actress in a musical, again, there was two people nominated, Elaine Stritch, Susan Browning, both lost to Helen Gallagher for No Nanette. No Nanette racked things up here. And then best actor in a musical, this was where Larry Kurt actually was nominated. So Dean Jones was not even nominated that year. Larry Kurt was, but he lost to Hal Linden for The Rothschilds. So those are the ones that they lost. But so 6 out of 14 is what they went home with.
I mean, that's
and the
not
first
a bad
time
take.
That Sondheim, yeah. And Sondheim won his first Tony Award
right,
for this.
Right. I feel like they took the big ones, you know, the ones that you want for a quality show. It's just
that's
the...
Right.
I think there's so many actors in this, and it was probably so different that it didn't.
Yeah, I could see. Yeah, that's the hard part about this show is that I think that it's the featured actors that have the better shot. Who knows? Maybe it'll break its curse here this year if Bobby wins.
If
maybe
we have
Katrina
Tonys,
Link will.
I mean,
if we have a Tonys even this year, who knows? Yeah. But it's like it's really a showpiece for them, and then Bobby has like being alive at the very end. So it depends on how you want to. Want to go with that.
Right.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for being with me here today.
Me,
We're here at the end of the show, at the end of our season. So I would also like to thank everyone for being along with this journey here over the last bunch of episodes. If people wanted to stay in contact with you, what's the best way to do so?
Yeah, so if you want to yell at me, go to Twitter. That's at TheEMRMusic. And if you want to not yell at me, but maybe hire me or check out my work, you can go to ericmatthewrichardson.com. Keep announcements there. I don't know what announcements are coming up because everything sort of shut down.
It's kind of in a holding pattern right now. Yeah.
Right. Therefore, I don't have anything to plug. I was going to plug that Merlin show. It might pop up again at some point. So I guess for now, I'm going to plug, let's say, a moratorium on 80s movies turned into musicals.
We can only hope.
Yes,
we can only hope.
Nothing in specific. I'm not attacking a specific person, but we'll just say.
I'm not attacking a specific person, but if we could like maybe hold off on the jukebox musical of a famous musician's life, just using their songs as the songs that people sing.
Yeah, there's definitely one of those that was going to come to Chicago. That is no longer, I think. So maybe there is some good out of this whole pandemic.
There's some good, yeah. Thank you again, Eric.
Thank you very much, Kyle.
Door chimes, in comes company. No strings, good times, just chumps company.
Thank you so much for listening. Also, a huge thanks to every single person who was a guest this season. Literally, I could not do this without you. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter or Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Any help you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to Pod Power this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. As you heard, the next few weeks I'll be taking off, so on the next episode we'll be talking about Follies. At the very least, some beautiful girls. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now. Company, lots of company.